my spare time, I serve as the chair of the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women, which is a job that I inherited when Susan retired. Our committee is really charged with looking at the advancement of women working in UC, and there are committees on every campus throughout the system, just like the one we have here at the Office of the President. Our committee is a newly formed committee, and Susan was our first chair, and we're growing and doing more activities. Those of you who are in the room, will you raise your hand so folks can see who the committee members are?
Can Emeritus members raise their
hand? Raise their hand. One of the things that this committee does is sponsor these noontime talks, because if you want to know how to be successful at UC, we should definitely learn from those who have come before us and who have certainly been successful in their careers. And Susan, we didn't get a chance to get her before she ran out the door, but she is a friend to UC and the committee, and we were certainly able to call her and ask her to come in and tell us a little bit about her story, which I'm sure you'll find exciting today. Now, I recognize that there is a pension, interesting enough, what are they calling it? A post-employment benefit forum, which starts at 1 o'clock at the Kaiser Building. Our talk today will probably go until about 12:45, and then we'll have a time for questions and answers. So if you have to leave, we won't get upset. I explained to Susan that some people might really want to know more about retirement. But there are those of us who will be riveted here learning how to survive in UC. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce Susan Thomas, and let's hear what she has to tell us about her time at UC. Thank you. All right.
It is such a pleasure to be here with you today. It's a little like coming home. Actually, it's a lot like coming home. And when Cheryl said I'm a friend of the University of California, I think that's almost an understatement. I've loved UC for a long time, and I think I will continue to for a very long time. In fact, I thought I'd mention today that I just changed my will and made a bequest to UC, which I mentioned to you today, not because that's such a great thing that I did, but I wanted to tell you that the reason I did that is because I heard from an OP employee 25 years ago that he had done that, and that he had done it out of gratitude for the best employer in the world. And I thought I would follow suit, and I thought I'd put it out there. For those of you old enough to think about things, give it some thought. I will say that had I been paid more, it would have been a bigger deal. Never mind that. I didn't come here for the money, and I know you didn't either. And so what we're going to talk about today, I'm going to tell you why I really did come here. I also promised to talk a little bit about work-life balance, but I will tell you right up front, I think I'm a better lawyer than a balancer. When it comes to balancing work and life, especially if you're a UC employee, it's something that can't be done with any elegance. I think what it is, like a lot of things in life, is an intention. It's something that you work toward. It's something you do your best at. It's something that I loved as much as I got right. But I'll share with you a few of the things that I did today that I thought actually worked out pretty well. And I will say, if you'll permit a moment of bragging, I couldn't be more proud and happy with the children and the stepchildren who have graced my life. Working backwards chronologically, my youngest duckling, Annie, is here at the table. She's a proud graduate of UC. She went to UC Davis and is preparing to go to seminary. My older daughter, Laura, who I hope is listening by phone, and if not, we'll pick it up on the website later, is finishing her doctorate at MIT, also a UC graduate. She went to UCLA. And my two stepchildren, I have a stepson named Alex, who has a doctorate in composition and music conducting, and he teaches at Washington State University. He's married to a young, aspiring opera singer, and is the father of a beautiful baby girl. And my stepdaughter, Heather, is an artist and the mother of two beautiful children in Salem, Oregon. And all of them are upright citizens. So, here's a little bit of the historical setting. I'm not as young as I used to be, so let me tell you a little bit about what it was like when I grew up. I grew up in Albany, just down the road a little bit. I learned how to roller skate with a key in the parking lot of the Bank of America just off of Solano. I was the Betty Crocker 1966 Homemaker of Tomorrow at Albany High School. This annoyed the home ec teacher greatly. And the reason it annoyed her that I got this award, which was given after a written exam, was because I did not take the required home economics class my senior year of high school. I persuaded my parents and brought a note to school. And because my parents were willing to back me up, I was excused from home ec so that I could take physics, which I thought was much more interesting. And that's what it was like in 1965. Required physics for boys, home ec for girls.
But you still got the prize.
There have been men in my life who have said, "And for you, tomorrow never comes." Fast forward a little bit. In 1979, I left a private law practice with in a high-rise building in San Francisco with a very sophisticated law firm, Forrester & Forrester, where I cut my baby teeth, lawyering, and packed up my books and came over to the Berkeley campus to take up residence in the funkiest office imaginable. It had wood paneling. It had a glass patio sliding door that opened onto a hallway, a metal desk, no telephone. But this was my new office at the University of California, and I could not have been happier. I was so happy to come here because I had finally landed a client with a mission that I believed in. And in spite of the fact that all of the accoutrements were not quite the same, the windows opened. That was really something that mattered to me. But MOFO was a very large and forward-looking firm in the 1970s, so I do want to tell just a couple of stories about that, because they were formative stories in both my personal and my professional life. Shortly after I was there, and I really was a baby lawyer, I was sent to work on two cases for a Dutch bank in Southern California. So I went down to the bank, met with the vice president, got to work, went back to MOFO the next day, and the partner said, "I need to talk to you. You need to know that the minute you walked out of the vice president's office, he was on the phone to me complaining about you." And I said, "Oh?" I couldn't imagine what I had done. And he said, "Yeah, this is what he said. I asked for a lawyer and you sent me a girl." What is this? To his credit, this partner from MOFO said, "She's a good lawyer. If you don't want her to work for you, you'll have to find a different firm." And as it turned out, the vice president, he also said, and by the way, she's never lost a case, which actually was true. I never tried one.
She's good.
I went to work. The cases came out extremely well. The vice president said, "I'd like to take you out for lunch. Let's go celebrate." And off we went, this is 1978, to the Jonathan Club in Los Angeles. And as we're walking toward the maitre d' starts shifting his weight from one foot to the other and looking very nervous, and finally looked at the vice president and said, "I'm so sorry, I can't seat you today." And there were lots of tables that were open. We stood there, and it slowly began to dawn on the vice president and on me that the reason I couldn't be seated was because I was a girl. And in fact, the vice president said, but she's my lawyer. And I realized I had become sort of a third gender. I was clearly not a boy, but I couldn't be a girl and a lawyer at the same time. I don't think I handled that extraordinarily well because I started laughing and couldn't quite stop. But But I will tell you that one of the cases that I handled for this particular bank was a sex discrimination case. So I felt like at least there would be continued employment for this particular client. The second thing that happened while I was at MoFo is that a young man I was dating dropped me and said, there's no point in dating you anymore because you're married to the law firm. That caused me to think a little bit. Now, this particular young man, I was not especially sorry to see him get on with his life. But it did make me stop and think a little bit, because I was working extremely, extremely long hours, working a lot, having a lot of fun. But I started to wonder about what it was I really wanted my life to look like later on. So this guy sort of got my attention. One of the things I did was I went around the law firm, I talked to a few of the women there, and looked at their particular lives, found nobody with an intact marriage, found that all of the women there, I mean, this was a long time ago, believe me, I think that women comprised somewhere between 10 and 12% of the law firm, and it was a very forward law firm. It had one female partner. they did not have intact marriages, and a couple of the women did not even have custody of their own children. And I looked at this profile, and I said, this is just not what I want. I think I'm going to see if I can find an in-house law position where I can work only 50 hours a week and maybe actually date, get married someday, and have a family. So I started to look for in-house positions, and the position at the University of California came open. It was 1979. The Higher Education Employer-Employee Relations Act had just been passed, so the University of California was thrust, kicking and screaming, into the vast arena of collective bargaining and unionization of its employees, from the faculty to the custodial workers. It was a big change in the University of California life, and they needed some labor lawyers. So it was my great good fortune to come to the university and enter into a career in that funky little office where every single case we took a legal precedent, because it was a brand new law. I don't see how it could have been more fun. I'll tell you, one of the things that brought me here in researching the position at UC, of course I love the mission. What's not to love? Teaching, research, and public service. I mean, that's really quite something. At the time at Morrison, I was working for a sugar company. I thought that this was a great mission. But I liked the fact that the California Constitution described the university as a public trust. That meant something to me. A trust is something that we hold in a vessel in safekeeping for someone else. And that means that we have certain obligations to the trust. And the word trust generates something meaningful to me. The University of California is a public trust for the people of the state. Part of what I thought was, it's going to be fun to practice law there because there's going to be a margin of ethics that I think will really be the right place to practice law. And it has been. The general counsel's office at UC wins cases because the lawyers are good, they work hard, the facts are good, we have really smart witnesses. And not because people cheat, it's because we do it the right way. And we do it the right way because we are the public trust. So I came over here. I learned every time I got a new case, the first question I asked was, are we right? And then after a while, I learned that I had to ask the question, are we right and can we win? And the answer wasn't always the same. Because occasionally you just have bad facts or you have a rotten witness, usually a doctor, but that's another story. And then I eventually learned to ask, are we right, can we win? And how will it look in the media? We are a public trust. We do operate in a goldfish bowl. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it's always going to be. And I'm sorry Lynn Tierney couldn't be here today, but I want to tell you we're in the best of hands right now when it comes to media relations. So see Lynn Tierney if you're asking that question and you don't know quite what to do with it. The first case I ever stood on the seat and tried for UC, this would have been in about 1980, I think. Actually went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And let's see, I think I only lost it 7 times on the way there. But it involved a request by a union to have access to the university's internal mail system. They wanted us to carry letters for them for free, which, as it turns out, we can't do because we're allowed to carry our own mail across postal routes under the Federal Private Express statutes, but we can't carry mail for anybody else. So that was a fantastic experience, getting all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It only took about 8 years, but we were victorious in the end. I do remember, I took one story from the Supreme Court argument, Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American justice, leaning over the bench and saying, if I vote for you, will my postage go down? Well, during the 8 years that this case was wending its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, I did manage to get married and started my family. And I had 2 baby girls, and I will say that 1985 was a very, very difficult year for me. My second pregnancy got complicated. I actually had to leave in the middle of a hearing, which was very graciously and capably assumed by another lawyer in the general counsel's office. Annie, thankfully, is a fighter because she was born with pneumonia, so it was a complicated launch for her, but she came through fine. But then when Annie was only 3 months old and my older daughter, Laura, was just 3 years old, my husband died suddenly in the middle of the night, and I was left as a very young widow with 2 babies and not knowing how in the world I was going to do this life, raise these children, continue to work, support this family all by myself. I don't think, I have never before or since been as scared as I was in that moment. And yet, here's what I learned. I learned some interesting things about the employer that I worked with. I learned a lot about the wonderful colleagues that I have in my office. They started the world's biggest and longest casserole brigade. A group of them got together and got theater tickets to get me out of the house once in a while for a year. The general counsel at the time asked me if I would like to, when I came back, work part-time. And I gratefully accepted, and I came back after an extended maternity leave, and worked part-time in varying percentages of appointments for almost 10 years. Now, I will say that I gave up some income and some service credits to do that, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. It made all the difference to me. Not just the part-time work and the opportunity to do it, but the support that I got from the Office of the General Counsel and from the Office of the President. I feel that I was very, very fortunate and had everything I needed to actually raise my children. So I want to tell you, to be honest, that for the next 10 years, I was not thinking much about work-life balance. I was thinking about survival. And that was kind of as good as it got. But I learned a few things about work-life balance that I'd like to share. First of all, if it's possible when one has small children, especially if one is a single parent, if it's possible to work part-time, do it. You will never regret the loss of income or the loss of retirement service credit. These are years you never get back. Second, it's critical to have loving people nearby. We heard this when Judy Sakaki was talking to us, being a single mother and having her grandparents help out. My parents were wonderful, so that my children also had loving grandparents to help out. But if you don't have grandparents nearby, there's something you can do about that. Make your own. I also adopted a grandparent who was a neighbor, a lady who lived across the street and who was widowed just 3 weeks after I was. We became very close friends. She was in her 80s. And Grandma Meg and my parents helped me very much to raise my children. Third, children are resilient. You can actually count on them to be accepting of the home life that they had. My two girls did not know that most families actually eat something different for dinner every night. Their mother cooked a big pot of something once or twice a week, and that was what we ate that week. And, they didn't know that it was different in other houses. They went to school some days when I had to travel with a toothbrush and a change of clothes in their backpack. And I used to feel like, oh, that must be so traumatic for them. What other children go to school with toothbrushes and a change of clothes in their backpack? But I kept watching them, and they never actually looked like they were traumatized. They would get picked up very reliably by my parents and by Grandma Meg. The only big flub up in a pickup time was yours truly, and they got through that. I learned that it's possible to fake being courageous, even if you're not. So I used to say to my girls, you don't have a thing to worry about. The most ferocious animal of any species is a mother protecting her young. So I am ferocious. And I think they believed it. I think after a while I believed it. I know they believed it, actually, because when they became teenagers, they would be saying things to me like, down, Mom, I'm going to handle this myself. So I think they were okay. I learned to schedule a day off for the first day of school each year. That was a momentous occasion for them, and it turned out it was always a momentous occasion for me, too. And it was very important to be physically present and emotionally available for that particular day. I also learned as much as I could work my part-time schedule to try to pick them up immediately after school at 3 o'clock because little ones are full of their day at 3 or 3:30. And when you're picking them up at 5:30 or 6, when everybody's catatonic and hungry, they can't remember as much about the day. So I didn't do it all the time, believe me, but I did it as much as I could. Once they were able to read, we had a family meeting. And I said to them, okay, I would like for us to have at least a few days when we get out of the house in the morning on time with everything we need and I haven't yelled. I think that would really be cool. So we worked up a chart that we called the Exit Adventure. And we posted the exit adventure on the front door at their level, reading level, and made a chart of everything that we needed to get out of the house each morning. And it was different, you know, Thursday is library day, Friday is pizza day, so you need pizza money, whatever. And, you know, field trip days, wear certain shoes. So we did all that, and it worked, not perfectly, but there actually were a few days in memory when we got out of the door on time with the things we need and nobody raised a voice. Okay, then I thought, children with a single parent need a court of appeal. So I made a court of appeal. Two colleagues in the general counsel's office agreed to provide this service. And I will say that my daughters actually only went to the Court of Appeal twice, and I lost both of them. That was how Annie got blue hair, and that is how both of the girls got clearance to get their ears pierced. But as you can see, OP was the village that helped me raise my children. It's just about the time it started to get easier. They were growing up and so forth. My life got complicated again. I remarried, and my new husband brought two more children to the mix, including a boy. And so we changed the gender balance dramatically in the household, and I started the adventure of blending a family with three teenagers. But I'll come back to that. Because meanwhile, there were some very interesting things going on at work, and I was also returning to work full-time. One of the great things about working at the Office of the President is that you can continue to work here and transform your career several times. It will keep you awake, and that is exactly what happened to me. I changed my substantive area of law practice three or four times while I was at the University of California. It was terrifying, and it was wonderful. So I did straight labor law, working with unions for the first 10 years or so. Then I took on the university's discrimination work and its affirmative action compliance. You know, the university gets zillions of federal dollars on the research front in contracts and grants, and so we have affirmative action obligations, which must mean that Betsy helped me with that for years. And it just so happened that I attended the Regents meeting in 1994 when the Regents decided to abolish affirmative action in admissions, contracting, and employment. That was an interesting meeting. My recollection is that there were three bomb scares that called for evacuation of the meeting completely. And I had a brand new cell phone. I'd never had one before, but I remember crouching in the parking lot and calling my new husband and saying, I'm still alive. And then Jesse Jackson was there. There were all kinds of demonstrations. It was a very exciting day. Eventually, they evacuated the board to an attic where by a 12 to 13 vote, the board voted in favor of essentially abolishing affirmative action at the University of California. For those of you who've been around for a while, you know that the Board of Regents voted to rescind that particular vote somewhat later, and that the law also has changed in the meantime a great deal. But it was a very, very active law practice. I do believe that the Regents' vote in that particular case sort of annoyed the federal government because they immediately launched five gigantic audits of the University of Affirmative Action Compliance, and that kept me very busy for the next several years. So in the meantime, on the home front, we learned the most critical tool of blending a family with family meetings. So we had family meetings once a week. We had three teenagers at that point at home, all involved in music and soccer in various forms, so that the first standing part of the agenda was always calendaring who had to be where when. And I do remember one particular autumn where I was in eight carpool. It was that was my personal best, I think. They weren't all ongoing all the time. Some of them were seasonal, but it was quite remarkable. The second thing, the second standing agenda item on the family meeting list was what's going on at school. The third thing was say something positive about your life or about someone in the family. And the fourth thing, the most critical, because they were all teenagers, was the hair report. So, but I will tell you that I think the family meeting, we also did workshops for the children. You can imagine how well they liked them. I did work on STDs, on drugs. I think the kids' mutual hatred of these workshops was really a bonding I don't think the workshops are the reason, but I will say, unfortunately, never had to face any of the heartache associated with problems like that. Okay, so back at the work front, I was still changing my law practice area from time to time. I took on disabilities law when the disability laws began to change and decided that when I grew up someday, I wanted to be a general counsel. So what do you need when you want to get ahead? We know that one of the things we need is mentoring. So how do you get mentoring if there's no mentoring program? Well, the answer is you do it by self. You pick your mentor and you start hanging out and watching him, which is what I did with the general counsel at the time, and you just start asking a lot of questions, which it turns out that Jim Holtz was gracious enough to answer. And then I worked on making myself useful enough to get to Regents meetings by studying parliamentary procedure, which is such an arcane thing to figure out how to do, but it was being used at Regents meetings. Of course, we have our own expert now. Charlie Robinson knows it pretty darn well.
I need your help.
So that was how I managed to sort of figure out how a general counsel operates with a board. And then I started doing some speaking at UC and nationally, and I researched and wrote and published a couple of papers. And these efforts were rewarded after a few years with a job offer from Hastings to come and be its general counsel. That was my alma mater. I was delighted. Since I've been with UC for 23 years at that point, it was a particularly inviting job offer because they're also in the UC retirement system. So I went over to UC Hastings and I was their general counsel. The first case that walked in the door was a copyright case, which gave me an opportunity to get to know the faculty, because I called up one of the copyright specialists and said, tell me everything you know, quick. So I was a general counsel at Hastings for 3 years, and I learned something very, very interesting about myself in that position. What I learned was that I was happier practicing hands-on law, solving problems, cleaning up messes, working with clients, doing the day-to-day legal work, and that I really missed the 800-pound gorilla of higher education, the University of California, and the way it generates cutting-edge legal problems at every turn. As a general counsel, I wasn't doing the stuff that I loved. I was overseeing other lawyers who were out there doing the work that I love to do. I was managing the budget, I was supervising, and I was going to a lot of meetings. a lot of meetings.
Sounds like fun.
I also learned that I don't have a particular interest or facility for corporate politics and palace intrigue. I have a friend here at OP who described my talents in this area as a death wish. she couldn't have been more right on. So when Jim Holtz offered me a position to come back to UC in 2004, I jumped at the chance. It was yet a new area of law that I had fallen in love with, and that was the business side of the house, the university life. So I came back in 2004 and undertook practicing law in finance and audit and Sarbanes-Oxley compliance and board governance. Really a very fun portfolio, and my last 5 years here were spent in that particular arena. I want to say this. I have actually worked in the corner office, and I've worked not in the corner office. And while it's not true for everybody, I think for me, it was the love of the real work that gave me the most satisfying career, and that where I belonged was not in the corner office. I belonged in an office doing the work I loved with the people I admired. And that has made me very, very happy over a period of 30 years. And that I think getting to the top is, for me, a matter of definition. I have had a fabulous career here, doing work I loved, with a family that I'm proud of, and I'm doing a lot of yoga now. Not a bad deal at all. So, today, from the comfort and enjoyment of the retirement life, I'll try very hard not to blow too much. I continue to learn and to look forward to a future that's filled with the kind of hands-on work that really means the most to me. But I want to tell you, it's been a great pleasure to come back here and speak with you today, and I will take some time for a few questions. And if you don't have any questions, I'll tell you about more cases.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions?
Yes. Susan obviously has an amazing and fabulous career. Looking back over your accomplishments, is there anything you want to say?
What was the question?
Is there anything I would have done differently in my career? Well, that's a really good question. I don't actually think so, but this is the reason why. I made a lot of mistakes, And but I think we learned from mistakes, especially doing the right thing. So I don't wish that I have gone back and done my life perfectly. I do wish I hadn't left my kids standing on the street corner. but no, I don't think so. I think it's a good idea to stretch outside of your comfort zone and find out whether or not you belong. And I'm glad I did. But I think it's very important to me to learn what it was that I love and to live in the world.
Any other questions?
Well, I guess I would have been more real. Any other questions?
Quick question. You know, standing in front of a maitre d' not letting you into a restaurant is unfathomable at this point. You know, to walk up into a place and not even be let in just is appalling from this perspective, on this side, right? And here you are, a young professional, and you're full of gumption still. So I'm curious how to balance gumption and professionalism at the same time.
I think the world changed around that. And I think when I was a young, new professional, that gumption was not quite as appreciated as I think it is now. So in terms of balancing gumption and professionalism, I would say gumption and gumption. because I think holding yourself back too much and being afraid to express who you are, because what you want to do is create an impression of professionalism, is probably not the most authentic way to live and to work. And frankly, at UC, sure, there is a fair amount of that, but let's face it, we don't have the budget. We don't have the tools we need. We have more work than we could ever get done, and we don't have enough staff. I mean, let's dispense with some of the silliness and get to work and do the stuff that really matters. And I think by your gumption, people will know you, and they will connect with you. I did forget to say one of my very favorite things about working in this huge bureaucracy, this lumbering bureaucracy, where it can be so hard to get things done, was figuring out how to connect with like-minded people and to develop these sort of these avenues of trust and reliance. When you meet people whose work you could actually rely on and trust, you sort of build up these networks. And I felt as though within the university, all across the system, there were all these sub-networks. After trying cases all over the system at every campus, every laboratory, and so forth, I knew a lot of people. I pick up the phone and get stuff done so fast. And I know that you're building up exactly those kind of networks now. I'm hoping that OP got shook up a little bit, or a lot, and that things are different. But that's actually how you get stuff done in a big bureaucracy and get it done fast. So I'm a big believer in getting the work done and doing it efficiently. So. But on the other hand, don't take advice on corporate politics from me.
Death wish.
Susan, you bridged a lot in your career, and I'm curious, you know, you had the office without even a telephone. What did you feel the day a personal computer landed on your desk? How did you feel that day?
I was ecstatic.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. The general counsel's office, well, let's just say as a sort of holdover from corporate politics dark era in the history of OP, that the general counsel's office was perfectly starved for resources during the 90s, and that everybody else in the university had emailed for years before our office did. It was so hard to get this law when we were so out of with the technological facility of our clients, a problem that can persist in some ways So by the time we actually got computers, it was like catching up.
Yeah, you're overdue.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. Now, email, I think, can be one of those things that can sort of eat up a day. I had to figure out after a while that it can lose efficiency, I think, because of email, and that it's better to sequester a certain amount of time each day for it. Otherwise, it's just too tempting to just answer emails all day and just get the real work done. Not that it isn't real work.
What were some of your more interesting cases that you worked on?
I have a case involving, it was a jurisdictional question involving whether or not hospitals could staff extracorporeal membrane oxygenation teams with respiratory therapists or if they had to be registered nurses. I'll explain what that is. But it was a fight between two unions to figure out what kind of staffing had to exist there. And in order to properly try the case, I had to learn what that was and how it worked. And what we were doing in our hospitals, and this was, 20 years ago, were saving the lives of premature babies at rates that exceeded anything the nation was seeing, because babies who were born quite prematurely did not have properly developed lungs. So they learned by, they would drug the infant so that the infant was very, very quiet. They would take the blood out of the infant, circulate it through a heart-lung machine, oxygenate the blood, and put it back in the baby. And what happened was that the baby's lungs would just rest. So that, and while they rested, it was no more elaborate than that. They learned that the human body, if it's given half a chance, will heal if it's allowed to rest. And the baby's lungs were continuing to develop while they were resting. And the survival rate of these premature infants was just simply phenomenal. It was my privilege to see a lot of young parents standing at the side of these babies that they knew were going to live and that a lot of people had told them wouldn't. This was the kind of thing I didn't see that I kept seeing over and over and over. I will say, as to these cases, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but what if I do? that I developed a personal opinion about research with animals as a consequence of that case. Because the research, in order to carry this out, meant that there had to be some practicing done on goats, and some of the goats died. But I saw a lot of human babies lost in the case, and also had the opportunity to meet some ECMO children who had grown up later on. So, the stuff that's going on at UC is pretty phenomenal. One other case I'll just mention briefly is involved a, and the case itself was not particularly riveting. Somebody got fired and they were not happy about it. Those things happen. But what I remember is the professor who was my star witness in that particular case. He was an electrical engineering professor and a quiet man who, as it turned out, he bought all of his own supplies because the university was having budgetary problems, and I found that kind of moving. He was so accessible to his students, and one night when I was preparing him to be a witness, he told me that I reminded him of a daughter who had died. It were these kinds of human connections, I think, as the cases unfolded, that made the difference to me and made me sort of fall in love with every single University of California location. Even though they were sort of different, they were all tied together. Any other questions? I could do more cases.
Well, let's do a couple of things. So, first of all, if you came in the room and you didn't put your name on a slip of paper, please do so. We have a raffle. We're getting ready to give Susan a bouquet of flowers, and we also raffle off a bouquet of flowers. Susan knows how this works. I'm going to take the liberty of, you know, taking the card and actually reading it to you as we present you with these flowers. Because I want you to know what we have to say. Dear Susan, thank you for your leadership and for providing inspiration to all the women of OP. Thank you especially for serving as the founding president of PACSON and helping to shape the goals and missions of this committee. We are indebted to you for your past and continued service. Sincerely, thank you very much. Here are the lovely flowers. Now, the funny thing is that Susan, when she was president, she used to be in charge of getting these flowers herself, so we're so excited that she's here. Negotiated a great deal. We have a little budget, and so Susan was able to negotiate a great deal to get us a good price. So, could we have one of Susan's guests pull the raffle ticket for us? And so, Annie, since you almost didn't make it here and we were in tears over that story, I think we'll have you pull this. Pull one, please. Okay. All right. Wow, now this has very fancy.
Howard Fallon.
Okay, thank you. Howard, is Howard here or did he leave?
Yeah, Howard!
Thank you, everyone, for attending today's lecture. We are trying to have more of these, and so we're getting a schedule together, and hopefully we'll have them posted on our website soon. We also, this is a commercial, we're going to work with External Affairs and HR and co-sponsoring one of these post-employment conferences that we're going to have. So there's one today, but we're going to co-host one as well because pension and retirement benefits that women don't often pay attention to because they're so busy taking care of everybody else. So we want to support that initiative and make sure that everyone is able to attend one of those. So Susan will be here for a while because I don't think people are going to let her out the door. If you'd like to continue talking to her, you certainly can. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.